So continuing with Taffy Bowen on 22nd June 78.
Yes, I can be quite factual about it. Well, because I was very close to some of the early planning for Green Bank. Lloyd Bergner discussed it with us extensively, and he asked us to go through the reports and make recommendations and so on. I knew what was involved, the size particularly, the kind of expenditure, the staff that they had in mind. Even the question of who should be director had been discussed to some extent. And it came as a tremendous surprise to me that it was offered to Joe. On the grounds that I knew Joe better than almost anybody at that time, and we've already mentioned his, the problem he had, you know, changing, making up his mind about anything.
Yeah.
But is it in the last year of his life with us, it was severe. It was a problem. Did you talk to Arthur Higgs when you were out there?
I did.
He was my technical secretary. He may not have mentioned this, but he and I used to discuss it quite often. It was a real problem. Well, unless we stood in personally for Joe on any problem that came up, there was never a hope of resolution. And
you just didn't know what was the cause of
it? Oh, we didn't know the cause of it. He was quite young still, 53 or 4 in those days. And when he accepted the Green Bank post, and this is very difficult to talk about, but I think I'd better. I didn't feel that I could talk to my American friends about it, but I went to Fred White, chairman of CSIRO, and said, look, no way that Joe's going to run that place. Hopeless case. He can't do it. Can we have a medical check or something? And there was, in fact, a medical check to see if he's fit for overseas. Travel overseas, but didn't show anything. So the decision, and Fred White, if asked about it, might remember this, was, well, he's passed his medical checks. Nothing we can do. Mm. So, let's say there were severe problems of that kind at that time, which we were vaguely aware of. We couldn't pin them down. And I just had to lump the whole problem into one piece and say, well, it's his decision if he decides to take it.
Yeah.
And the Americans want him to take it. Well, nothing I can do. So it...
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Very difficult.
Were there other people in the staff that noticed?
Not as, I would say Arthur Higgs was a man who would know about it as clearly as I did. And I won't give, you know, gruesome details, but always memory of things after 24 hours and gone.
What do you think was the motivation from his point of view? I mean, once again, he wasn't administratively inclined.
No, I don't know. He was in bad shape. In no shape to make a decision of that kind.
Right, well, thank you very much.
Great.
So just a couple other questions. First of all, could you just tell me what your educational background was?
Well, BSc, first class honors in physics, University of Wales, 1930. Long time ago.
So, are you Welsh then?
Welsh born.
I see.
Born and bred in Swansea, South Wales, which is where I went to university. That was 1930. A year later, an MSc for research, also University of Wales, 1931.
In what fields now are these?
Oh, that was X-ray crystallography, which is a bit of a specialty, you know, mineralogy and all that stuff.
But physics, though.
But in physics. Then I went to work with Avildsen at King's College in London and got a PhD, London University, 1934, predominantly cosmic rays. And that's it. I got an honorary DSC from Sydney University in 1957.
How is it that you happened to get involved with radar then, if you've done your thesis in cosmic rays?
Well, predominantly because I should have said cosmic rays and thunderstorms. You know, there was thought to be a connection. So at that time, I did a lot of observing at the radio research station in Slough, outside London, the superintendent of which was Watson Watt.
Yes, okay.
So that was the connection, and then when the radar thing started, I was looking for a job, and Watson Watt was looking for staff, so...
And this would be, what year would that be?
1935.
35. Mm-hmm. Okay, another question that I meant to ask was the relationship between optical and radio astronomy. As you look back over, say, the 20 years after the World War II, do you ever feel that radio astronomy merged into optical, or has it always remained somewhat of a separate discipline?
Well, in Australia, again, the situation I think was unique. We've referred to the problems with Woolley, the great astronomer, but a transformation took place when Bart Bock came out as director.
Mm-hmm.
And he, of course, had a radio astronomy connection back at Harvard with a 60-foot dish. And when he came out, the situation was transformed. It was a completely collaborative effort. He with responsibility for optical astronomy, and we were responsible for the radio, and everything went swimmingly from there on. He supported us in our proposals, whatever they might be, and later in the piece we were strongly supporting him, of course, when he was advocating a 150-inch mm-hmm. optical telescope.
That would be when, the early 60s?
Early to mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
And this came to fruition, of course, with the joint Anglo-Australian telescope.
Many years later.
Many years later, it was commissioned in 1974 or thereabouts. So much so that I was chairman of the board for about 6 years of the preparatory period, the actual building period.
And it's probably fair to say that that optical telescope is more like a radio telescope in many of its design aspects than...
Well, and certainly in the control,
right.
Which of course is outstanding.
But what about on a worldwide scale? For instance, I asked you, you said you've actually never been to an IAU General Assembly.
That's
and yet
true.
You've been to countless IRSI ones, and so you must not feel a real need to talk to astronomers, per se. Yourself, anyway.
Well, just going back a little again, I think when I was chairman of the AAT board, I realized for the first time that there was a profound difference between the way that optical astronomers look at things and radio astronomers.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably true that nobody's had a gold medal of the Royal Astronomical Society for building a telescope. But builders of telescopes are, you know, outside the pale, as it were. In radio astronomy, of course, it's the engineers and the builders who made radio astronomy right from the jump.
Right.
So
this is even in the 70s, you saw this attitude.
Very much so.
And not just, Woolley was also on this committee, but not just Woolley.
It's through and through, and I'm talking about every country except perhaps the United States, where people like Bruce Rule and Ike Bowen, of course, have got standing in the field, but anywhere else
mm-hmm.
in the world. And the telescope builders are somebody you call in like a garbage man.
Right, right. Or the plumber, maybe.
The plumber.
So it sounds like you're saying then that the two disciplines, even until recent times, are quite distinct in their philosophy, and you don't see a whole lot of amalgamation in...
I didn't mean to give that impression
okay.
at all. No. This was certainly true in the 40s when radio astronomy started, in the early 50s. As I see it, the amalgamation has taken place.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it has already occurred.
And when do you think that took place?
I was middle 60s, certainly by the late 60s, early 70s. The collaboration couldn't be more complete or
But still, rather distinct styles, though.
Oh, yes. Well, there are still different styles, and of course, as we see it, the optical astronomers are rapidly catching up. I mean,
yes.
Instrumental attachments to telescopes,
right.
And electronics and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But that lesson from that.
Right. Okay, thank you. There's the interview with Taffy Bowen on 22nd June, 78. His home in West River, Maryland, on the western shore of Chesapeake Bay.